Welcome to the Midday. I'm Norman Gilliland, and we'll have a quiz question as usual at 12:30. It's already here. It's maybe the shortest one in history. So short there's not even room for a question mark at the end of it. Between now and then, we have Jeremy Denk. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you.
Jeremy Denk is performing tonight at the Wisconsin Union Theater in Madison. That's at 7:30. He's playing just two works, but it'll be a full concert nonetheless. The Piano Sonata No. 1 by Charles Ives, and the entire Goldberg Variations of Johann Sebastian Bach. What made you decide to put those two together?
There's a long and a short answer to that question, but of course they're very different pieces to the ear, but there's a lot of hidden connections between Bach and Ives.
Really?
Yeah, sure. They were both, of course, organists.
True.
By nature, and they were both rebuked by their various congregations adding too many dissonances to the hymns.
That's right.
They both spent a lot of their lives improvising on hymns, and there's a strong connection, I think, between the Lutheran Bach and the more Protestant, different Protestant Charles Ives. And also, you know, the Goldbergs is a piece in which over a single bass line, Bach throws everything but the kitchen sink in. You know, every possible version of the bass line, every possible genre. You know, and then very at the end, nostalgically looks back by repeating the theme. That's a very Ivesian thing to do, to try to create transcendence by throwing everything in, having this sense of every path from the highest to the most, from the most serious to the most ridiculous.
The Goldberg Variations of, I wouldn't say caught on exactly is quite the right word, but in the last 50 years or so, have really become very well known as piano, as a kind of a massive piano work, and in maybe the last 20 years or so, a number of pianists have taken it on. Have you heard those, or do you simply come to terms directly with the Goldberg yourself and make it your own?
Well, I mean, of course, I've heard some of them, not certainly all of them. You know, and those sometimes they're very interesting to me, and sometimes I just ignore them because they don't speak to me in one way or another. But you know, obviously, you can't go into the Goldbergs without knowing the Glenn Gould version. It's somehow part of the water that we're drinking.
With two different versions, of course, very different over a long period of time in between.
Right. And he, of course, he's a great genius. I have the feeling he kind of saved the Goldberg Variations and kind of ruined them at the same time, in the sense that it's sort of impossible to get his version out of your mind.
Really?
Once you
first or the second?
Either one, yeah. But, you know, that said, you know, I just try to play it. You know, I have my own fairly strong vision of what the piece ought to be and how I think of it. It's a very emotionally kind of cathartic piece to me, very special piece. You know, so I've managed to slightly put Glenn Gould to the side of my mind a little bit.
have you recorded the Goldbergs?
I haven't, but I'm thinking about it.
You have recorded Bach, and you have recorded the Ives. It's on the
both
tonight.
Ives sonatas came out last year, and then both three Bach partitas came out in January. Yeah.
You have you become part of this phenomenon that's a whole new, I think, relationship between the performer and the audience, which is to say you're quite the blogger.
Yes, although I've been a bad blogger the last few months. But
well, but what's there is certainly detailed. In fact, you even include musical illustrations in your kind of musical ruminations and that kind of thing. Does the responses you get to the blogs affect what you choose to play and how you play it at all? How do you respond to responses to your blogs?
Do you mean the comments on my blog?
Do they
cause? Mm-hmm. Interesting. Not for the most part. Mostly the comments are about whatever I'm talking about on the... I would say more often what happens is I write a blog about a piece that I'm playing, and somehow the fact of that I've refined what I thought about the piece, somehow the act of writing about the piece reflects back onto how I think about playing it. And so that does affect my performing. Yeah.
Well, we have some performances you have reflected on just since you've been in the studio here. You've kind of, I don't know if renounced is quite the right word. But
well, they're old. These are old performances. You know, it's from a past Denk.
a previous thought, you might say.
Yeah, but this is with my friend and wonderful violist Roberto Diaz, I think, if I understand what you're going to play next.
Yeah, we'll be hearing some Brahms. We'll be hearing one of the movements from the three viola sonatas that you have recorded.
There's actually only two viola sonatas, and then he got a transcription of the G major violin sonata, and we recorded that, which is complicated because the piano is suddenly playing very much lower than usual.
Well, we'll hear the final movement, Vivace, from the sonata in F minor of Brahms with you, Jeremy Denk, and violist Roberto Diaz.
Yeah.
The finale, vivo, or vivace, I should say, of the sonata in F minor for viola and piano by Brahms, with my guest today, pianist Jeremy Denk, and violist Roberto Diaz.
Currently president of the Curtis Institute of Music.
Is he?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that raises an interesting question about your academic connection with Bard.
Uh-huh, right.
And the Bard College Conservatory of Music. Bard is it Bard in general, or is it the conservatory that has this unusual 5-year plan? You actually have to have like a double major and be there for 5 years.
Right. They have this is sort of Leon Botstein's brainchild, which is a program only for students who want to study music and an academic field simultaneously. A special kind of conservatory liberal arts education combination. You know, and I went to Oberlin specifically for that sort of thing, to get a double degree at the college and to get
your music and chemistry,
piano performance and chemistry, right? And so they have a lot of faculty, obviously, from the New York area. Bard is up the Hudson a little bit, I really have a very part-time position there for the time being, and kind of running around a little bit too much to pay proper attention to students full time, but I do go up there, and sometimes students come down to the city and take lessons, and it's a cool idea. The thing is that to find the right kind of student who is academically very curious and interested, and who is also a conservatory level musician.
You have, let's see, also in the music the piano faculty, I should say. It's Rudolf Serkin and Richard Good.
Not Rudolf, Peter. Peter. mean, Rudolf would be quite a trick.
Yeah, so
but
Peter Serkin
and Richard Good, they right. come in and do a lot of teaching. And they're present and part of the faculty, and they help out the students. So.
I gather no problem getting students with that kind of diversity of interest. We seem to see a lot of it in music these days, where the two seemingly unrelated fields of a music major and then, a math or a science.
Right. You see a fair amount of that. That's true. Very often a student gravitates pretty quickly to one or the other. That's part of college. It's part of life at college, is getting to know what you're really going to do with your life.
So that was the case for you, that you gravitated away from chemistry?
Yes. About halfway through my Oberlin, I realized that I truly hated chemistry. And plus, I sort of realized I was pretty incompetent in the lab. I was very good on paper as a chemist, but much less so with the beakers and the Bunsen burners and the...
Well, I was reading about Robert Oppenheimer the other day. Same problem for him. Fantastic physicist, but people made fun of him for his clumsiness in the lab. So,
I think I had even trouble washing my dishware properly, which is a problem that translates into my daily life too.
Yeah, you have actually, I have to say, one of the more entertaining blogs.
Well, thank
in
you.
Terms
thank
of. You. I wouldn't call it stream of consciousness, but we get a lot of detail in terms of the comic nature of everyday life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's a crucial part of the blog for me. And, a lot of musician blogs are like, I went here and it was fabulous. The audience was so great.
Yeah.
Everything is sunny.
It's very glossy.
It's very happy. And I think that's great, too. But mine is a little bit more sort of, for me, the real joy of being a musician is total immersion in the music itself. And the glamour of of running around and touring is, you know, there's some very glamorous elements to that, and there's some very unglamorous elements to it. And so I tend to point out that, you know, the sort of comic undertone of everything. You know, you're constantly meeting people that you don't know, presenters, people, audience members, and there's all kinds of weird things that can happen, of course.
All right. Yeah. I'm game. What's a weird thing?
Oh, you know, people saying, it was a very funny, Josh Bell and I were playing a concert in Stuart, Florida. And it was a big honor because we were playing a piece by Izai, the famous violinist.
Sure.
And Izai's granddaughter was actually at the concert. She lived in Stuart or somewhere nearby, West Palm, who knows. So she was there, and it was a big honor to go and meet her. And we're out signing CDs, and we still hadn't seen her, and everyone said, oh, she's coming. And then she comes up to me, and she says, wow, you're very good. Are you a professional musician? And, you know, obviously she meant that as a compliment, but, or she may have even said, you could be a professional musician. And it was this great honor of meeting her mixed with this incredibly insulting remark.
Kind of a burnished or muted honor.
Yes, yeah.
Here you are again. This is the recording we just heard of the Brahms dates from 2008. This, I think, is a little earlier than that. And it puts you in the chamber music context again, but you say that you really enjoy chamber music.
Well, you know, I play a little bit less the last few years, but I did. You know, I went to Marlboro Festival, which is sort of chamber music, Nirvana or whatever.
Sure.
And, you know, I have so many wonderful friends and colleagues who I've played with in various capacities, and, you know, done a tremendous amount of chamber music and recitals. Of course, toured with Josh Bell for 5 or 6 years doing dual recitals. So, yeah. It's all part of my life.
This is the third movement, the Scherzo from the piano quintet in A by Dvorak. And the pianist here, my guest today, Jeremy Dink. There you have the third movement, the Scherzo, from what might be called the American Quintet, the piano quintet in A of Dvorak, but with a different twist. Of course, we heard, as mentioned, our guest today, Jeremy Dink, as the pianist there, but usually you hear that in the original form, which was for piano and for strings. But you like it better this way, do you think?
I think it's a very fresh take on it. It's a lot of friends of mine who are great wind players in New York scene, you know, the David Jolly, the horn player who's been with Orpheus for many, many years and all around, and Tara Helen O'Connor, the amazing flutist, and Frank Morelli, kind of a legend of the bassoon world around the East Coast. And so these guys are always trying to grab, you know, pieces from the string repertoire because, you know, the wind repertoire is not as large as they'd like it to be.
Sure.
And this piece, you know, there's something about the Czech sound and the sort of idea of a wind band or the street wind band.
Big tradition.
You know? Yeah. And so the thought that it might sound kind of wonderfully idiomatic and very folky, you know, folk bandy to do it. And, you know, I think it works.
Well, I think
some
so,
extent.
Too.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, Dvorak did write that, you know, wind serenade.
Yeah.
That this is kind of a first cousin to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The beginning of the first movement is very beautiful because it's horn, usually a cello solo, which is very nice. But it's actually, I think, even a bit more magical with French horn playing it. Don't tell any cellists I said that.
All right. We'll keep that under wraps.
Yes.
What's up next? So you're playing tonight, of course, at the Union Theater. I should reiterate there that you're playing the Charles Ives Piano Sonata No. 1 and the Bach-Goldberg Variations that have, more, as it turns out, more connections than we might think for composers who lived a couple hundred years apart.
Yeah.
And that's tonight at 7:30 at the Union Theater. And
The Ives is a big raucous favorite piece of mine to play.
Is that another one of those, like, two different bands playing at once kind of things that he does?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, Ives was obsessed with the idea of things, layers of things,
yes.
You know, and the present, very often obsessed with something happening in the present and a memory happening at the same time, or two different lines He loved kind of sometimes chaotic pileups. There's an amazing, there are four different scherzos in this sonata. They're all based on ragtimes, and each of them gets a little drunker than the last. And there's an amazing sort of full-out honky-tonk bringing in the sheaves that happens in the last one.
And he loves to do that.
There's a complete, unbelievable chaos climax, chaotic climax, which is just a blast and a half.
Who did you record that for? What label?
My label.
Oh, good.
Me.
And is it called the Me label?
Or it's called, yes, it's called label? The Me label. It's called Think Denk Media, because Think Denk is the name of my blog. Because, of course, Denk means
for thinking.
Think, yeah. Think Tank. And you know, uh-huh. So you can, it's an annoying pun, but Think Denk Media is the label, and you can buy it, you know, anywhere, Amazon or whatever.
Available in fine stores everywhere.
And, yeah, it's a special love project of mine that I did.
And what else is on that CD?
Both Ives sonatas. Oh, the very different second sonata, which is more famous in a way,
sure.
And also about all the transcendentalists, you know, Emerson and Thoreau and Hawthorne,
oh,
all those
very
guys.
Very much a New England composer, wasn't he?
Yes. And this, you know, that's a very magical piece, has a different kind of, it's a very transcendent piece, as you might expect.
From
yeah.
Ives.
Yeah.
And so where are you going next? What's up? What's on your horizon?
I've had a kind of crazy spring, so the next thing I'm doing is going home for a few days. I'm going to Kalamazoo playing next week, and then most of May until I go off, you know, all summer is festivals. You know, I'm going to London for a little while, then I'll be in beautiful Detroit, and then I'll be in Santa Fe and Aspen and, you know, a lot of the Grand Tetons and, you know, summer festival time.
Sounds
LA, yeah.
Genteel if wearing.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. You know, it's a lot of different things, of course. It's like a non-stop. So I need May to practice all my tunes.
And catch up on the blog.
Catch up on the blog, eat some good food, you know, get my life together, do the laundry.
there's always the mundane. Yes. Mixed in with the glory. Well, thanks for stopping by, Jeremy.
My pleasure. Pleasure. Thank you.
It's been fun talking to you and hearing your music. And his name is Jeremy Denk, and he's out there on CDs and at festivals and concerts such as the one tonight at the Union Theater.